Veritex Community Bank Studios. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, Bankstown? Hey! How we doing?
He's Blank, I'm Branham. Brendan behind the glass. It is a Thursday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. It is official, Blankers.
It's your birthday.
It is my birthday, yes, but that's secondary.
But that's official.
Back of mind. Yes, it is official. A little, you're older, a little more gray in the beard. But the Astros have broken New York fans.
Oh, is that right?
Shut the f*** up, Fred! Shut the f*** up! Let's go! They're not hitting with you! They're the best team in the National League! Oh, they lose one f***ing game!
They lost 400! They lost 400 last six! They're falling apart!
They've lost 5 of 6. The Braves don't lose. Those are a bunch of Patrick Creighton Mets fans sitting around from Barstool watching that Mets-Astros game yesterday. The Astros have broken New York. Can you believe it?
I really can't, just simply because we're realistic baseball fans of the Astros that saw this gauntlet of games, and we're going to be okay with winning 5 at the most.
Yeah.
But even being okay with 4 and 5 out of the 9 games. And now here we are sitting pretty going, if not for the bullpen collapse in 2 of those games, you might be running the table on the 2 best teams in baseball, both out of the Big Apple, and it has been impressive.
6 of 8 in the Gotham Gauntlet. As you alluded to, the 2 games that you lose, you had the lead late. The first one you lost, you had the lead in the 9th, 3-run lead. The second game that you lost, you had a 2-run lead in the 8th. So the Astros have dominated the Gotham Gauntlet any way you look at it, whether you look at it at innings trailed or you just look at the wins, right? Well, it's always about the wins. That's what people were saying when the Astros lost or when they split the series in New York. It doesn't matter how you lost. It's all about if you lost. Okay, that's fine. The Astros have won 6 of 8 in this Gotham Gauntlet. Starting the Gotham Gauntlet, it was all about, oh, can the Astros contend? Are the Astros a World Series contender with the way that they're currently built, currently constructed? And not only did the Astros prove that, yes, they are, but they've broken New York. They have dented the Big Apple, which, being in Houston, everybody loves.
Well, everybody from the New York Post headline people that are basically congratulating the Astros and being impressed by them, to just the whole city being somewhat scared and worried of the fact that not only is your worst nightmare still around, but you thought going into this stretch that you could prove that the Astros are finally down for the count and they're not going to be as good as the 2 teams in your fair city. And now what you're facing is the harsh realization that not only are they still around, but they're still your daddy in the case of the Yankees. And if you're looking for a stepdad with the Mets, hey, you know what? They might be up for adoption.
Robert Manfred's weeping. He's weeping because he talks about how much Yankee and Mets baseball that he watches in that interview he had with ESPN. But nice to see that from the Astros, and love seeing the reaction of Mets fans. Oh, the Astros, they broke the Mets. It's always great to see. A lead story from yesterday's game. It's pretty obvious. We were in here. We'll pull the curtain back for a second. We were watching the game. We were watching the game yesterday as it was going on. We thought it started at 3:05. We were wrong. We were watching the game, and whenever it happened, Yordan Alvarez colliding with Jeremy Pena, it certainly caught our attention, and it caught the entire city's attention. Yordan having to get carted off the field. Jeremy Pena leaving the game, mouth laceration there. They're being checked for concussions. I think it is a good sign. I saw McTaggart and Rome both tweet this, probably came from the team, that they were on the flight back to Houston. I think that is very critical in terms of their long-term success.
Yes.
Like, are they in the lineup today? I mean, we'll have to see. But I think that the fact that they flew back with the team is a great sign.
It is, because medically, if it is... there are serious concerns with a concussion. You are not supposed to fly, and there are ramifications for if you do, and teams wouldn't be willing to take that risk. So the fact that they were on the flight and flew back was a good sign. The fact that after the game, when the media was allowed around the team, Yordan was walking around under his own power in and out of the locker room and doing what he needed to do. The worst of all of it looked like it was taken by Pena, and then to hear that he had a laceration in his mouth, but if that's it, then you're fine with that too, because I actually went back and watched the replay and slow-mo'd it several times, and Yordan, the worst of it, was basically the glove hand to the face, Jeremy Pena's glove hand with the ball in it to the face. But I don't think he suffered anything more than that. And then the brunt of it was taken by Peña, who basically was almost like a clothesline hit in football. But essentially, aside from his face making the contact with Yordan, which is the best case scenario, he landed on his back and his butt, and he didn't, you know, jar his head or anything. So I think they got very lucky.
I do, too. It was weird. Like, to me, you're right. Like, watching that over and over again, because I did the same thing because it happened while we were on the air. I thought that Peña took the extent of that collision. Mm-hmm. And Peña actually lunges back to catch the ball at the last moment and then runs into the freight train known as Yordan Alvarez. And he went flopping back to where he came from, almost went hill over head. So I was surprised that it was Yordan that was the one that was a little slower getting up, especially when you consider the size. And look, Peña's no small man either. The dude is built like a Greek god. But Yordan's much bigger in size. So I was surprised it took Yordan a little bit longer to get up. I had some people telling me that Yordan was babying it a bit. For having an honest conversation, do you think that's a fair remark?
I would say this. I didn't think he needed the cart.
The cart was, I mean, the cart was up there with Odorizzi leaving on a cart with a sprained ankle.
Yeah, I just did not. Odorizzi's at least looked like it was so much more severe. Yeah. And if we were thinking it was a blown Achilles, yeah, you can totally understand someone, you know, a guy not being able to get off the field under his own power. Yordan looked like he could actually stay in the game. So, but I was like, when they kept bringing the cart, I was like, someone's going to wave that off.
I didn't think he was going to sit on it.
I actually thought Peña might stay in the game at first.
He tried.
He got up first, but then he walked off the field. I'm like, if the guy that took the worst of it is the guy that walked off the field, pretty sure Yordan didn't need the golf cart.
We love Yordan, obviously. Maybe the best hitter in all of baseball. Remember whenever he hurt his hand and we thought he broke his hammock? Like,
yeah,
we found out it was just like a bruised hand, and like he kind of overreacted a little bit to that as well. Like, just kind of keep that in mind with Yordan Alvarez. We wouldn't trade him for the world, but just consider that. Hopefully they're both in the lineup today. Dusty said that both Peña and Yordan were advocating to stay in the game yesterday. So we'll see if that is
but
the case.
Dusty, who normally is our voice of reason to give us what really is going on with injuries, yeah, was the guy after the game that kind of sensationalized it even more by going, well, we don't want to jump to conclusions and we don't want to go too far too fast and, you know, and try to say, well, it was kind of a big deal. And okay, what is it?
Yeah, he was vague. He was vague. But whenever they tell you something, they mean it. They're very truthful whenever they're telling you something definitive. Now, watching that play back, too, and I understand that Jake Meyer's just a couple of games back. I understand that Peña's built like a Greek god. I understand that Yordan Alvarez is a freight train. As a center fielder and a leader of the outfield, you think Meyer should have been one of the ones calling that ball?
No question about it. Jeremy, I played center field for the majority of my baseball career.
Watching that back, that was my biggest takeaway.
You are, without question, you are the sheriff of the outfield.
Yep.
And so you are the guy that calls the other two corner outfielders off. You are the guy that dictates. And especially the other key here is when the infielder's back is to home plate,
yeah,
that is where you have to be the intermediary who jumps into it and says, either Yordan, you take it, or Jeremy, it's all yours. But you have to be yelling because Yordan's not a very vocal guy anyway.
It looked like he was calling for it, but I couldn't really tell. Like,
and normally, especially if it's loud too,
yeah,
you do the wave of the glove. You do the wave
of
the arm.
Well, neither one was camped under it.
No.
Like, yeah, so that was tough.
But because of the fact that your infielder's going back to the home plate, that's where the outfielder has to take charge no matter what, and whoever's going to interrupt or police it has got to be the center fielder to call all shots and just start screaming, that's Yordan, take it, you know, JP, get off.
I thought he should have called it. I thought he should have came, take charge as the
that's
sheriff
the
in center field.
Happen, yeah.
You could tell he was, then we talked about this with Myers too, coming back, that you can see that he's still a little bit tentative, mm-hmm, around obstacles. And we noticed it with the wall because that's where he tore his labrum last year in the playoffs, or at least that's where the injury started, is when he crashed against the wall against the White Sox in the division series. And we've seen, small sample, since he's been back with the Astros, that he's been a little worried about the wall. And I think he was a little tentative yesterday going for that fly ball. Now, we don't know the communication. Like, I saw some people saying that Yordan was calling for it, the Peña was calling for it. Very clearly to me, neither one hurt each other. So, like, even if Myers is the one taking charge there, you might have a three-way collision. Because it didn't seem like anybody was able to hear the other person in that collision heard around the world.
Yeah, no. I mean, look, like I said, best case scenario, especially with, and I heard the wheelhouse, I heard BK and Jake going back over this, the fact that the Astros only list a 20-pound difference between Yordan and Peña is a little bit far-fetched. Because when you look at that, and like you said, it's one thing to say a freight train, but that is a big-ass freight train rolling down the tracks with a lot of momentum behind him. And then to hit a guy like Peña, who's also no small potato, but still smaller than Yordan, and because of what they mean to the team, right? You got a guy that's basically in the MVP conversation that's your best hitter and player. You got a guy that's been, you know, completely the surprise of the entire season by what he's been able to do at shortstop. You lose one or both of those guys for any extended time or possibly longer. I mean, everything that you've built to this point goes completely out the window.
Jeremy Peña's been really good as a rookie, right?
Yeah.
He's a contender for the rookie of the year. He's hitting .275. He's almost got 10 home runs in his rookie season. He's playing a very good defense. We look at the defensive WAR numbers all the time. Walking, getting on his feet and walking off the field under his own power after he collided with Yordan Alvarez at that velocity and at that rate that we saw yesterday is the most impressive thing that Jeremy Peña has done as a Houston Astro. That he got onto his own feet after running into Yordan Alvarez and left the game walking off under his own power is by far better than the .275 average, the 9 home runs, the defensive WAR. That was the most impressive thing we've seen the rookie do as a member of the Houston Astros.
And he held onto the ball.
And he held on to the ball.
That was very impressive.
He held on to the ball.
I remember, you know, and they made a big deal of it here at the station, and they actually put the picture out there, which didn't do me any favors in the way it came out, but it was the fact that I don't think either one of us have ever been speechless, and that especially even no matter if Brendan's in our ear or something happens on the TV or otherwise, we just finished the segment. I literally stopped.
Yeah, whenever, see, I didn't see it, but I saw you stop. I was like, something's up.
Yeah,
and then I looked over and was like, oh wow.
And I was like, oh no. Yeah, that would have been devastating. So the fact that we come out of it being able to kind of chuckle about it a little bit is such a massive release.
What are the chances that one or two of them are in the lineup today?
I told Brendan that, you know, when we were talking about it yesterday, I wouldn't expect either one of them in the lineup
today. I think
today
we see one, maybe both. We'll see.
Okay.
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776, twitch.tv/ESPN975. He's at Pac-Man Joel on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Branham. All right, Yordan Alvarez should never play defense again. But where does that stack up amongst the other long-term Astros thoughts, the trade deadline, the batting order? Where does Yordan Alvarez should not play defense rank amongst those? It's the Killer Bees, ESPN97.5, ESPN92.5.
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
That one's popped high in the air. Jeremy Peña drifts out. Yordan Alvarez coming in, and they collide. Peña and Alvarez hit hard in shallow left field. Peña's still down, and he held on to the baseball. One of the two held onto the baseball. The out's been called. Both Yordan and Peña are down.
Our friend Todd Callis yesterday wasn't sure who held onto the baseball, just that somebody did. That was the collision heard around the world, the perennial rookie of the year, the potential rookie of the year, and the potential MVP colliding in shallow left field at Citi Field, artist formerly known as Shea Stadium. Scary sight. It looks like the Astros could have dodged a bullet there, awaiting results on the concussion protocol. I think it's a very good sign, as you mentioned, that they were able to fly back with the team. We'll get more into that in a minute, because Killer Bees have been telling you for a long time that Yordan Alvarez should not be playing at least left field. We've been calling for him not to play defense at all, with maybe one exception. We'll get to that in a second. There's a Yankee fan in Austin who is texting the program.
Oh, my God, he does
512
all the time.
Area code. He said, how did they dominate the Yankees? You're acting like they won the World Series whenever they just took 2 of 4. I think if you were to break down that series a little bit closer, the Yankees only led twice the entire series for the 37 innings that they played, and that was at the last at-bat in Game 1 and Game 4 of that series. If you were to say which of these two teams dominated the other in that four-game series, yes, it was a 2-2 split. It was the Astros. And if you're taking 2 of 4 on the road from the best team in the American League, that is a positive. Like, I always look at the 7-game series, right? If these two teams were to meet in the postseason, it's an ALCS. If they're meeting in an ALCS, it's 7 games. If the Astros went into the Bronx, because the Yankees are probably going to have the best record in the American League unless the Astros charge late, which I don't think that they will. I think the Yankees will finish with the best record in the American League. We would be thrilled and over the moon if the Astros took 2 of 4 at Yankee Stadium.
No question about it. And here's the thing. And it's the same guy all the time that somehow, you know, forget about it. The Yankees are the Yankees, and you guys freaking suck. Well, guess what? You're the Utah Jazz of the playoffs for the last, like, 12 years. So get over yourself and grab a hot dog on the side of the street, okay? Because here's the thing. You get owned and your daddy wears orange and blue, okay? And you haven't proven to be able to do anything no matter what you've done in the regular season. The fact that you were no hit for seven innings or more in the series, and you never led until those last two at-bats in two of the games because of the implosion of the bullpen, you should be more than concerned. You should be worried because it looked like you were going to have a cakewalk. And most of the national reporters were thinking, yeah, the Astros are finally on the way down. They're not the team that they've been over the last 5 years. Well, hate to break it to you, but we just took the quote-unquote two best teams in baseball to the woodshed. Yeah. And just showed you exactly who the Astros still are and that they're not going anywhere. So you can sit there and act cocky and talk about, yeah, you know what, you didn't show us anything because we got the judge and the jury and everybody else on our side. Well, guess what? You need them. Because right now, you haven't proven anything to anybody. And coming out of that, aside from some fluky power rankings, because you still have a good record, believe me, in baseball circles, and nobody trying to think that this is a cakewalk for the Yanks.
You took 6 of 8 against the two best teams in baseball. That's really all you got to say. And you went into the Bronx and you took, yeah, you split the series, but that's a positive whenever you go into the best record in all of baseball and you split the series. And also, if you read between the lines in the games that they lost, dominated those games as well. 713-780-ESPN. Of course, there's a Yankees fan in Austin. Next thing you know, a Dodger fan is about to text or call in. 713-780-3776. Somebody's saying, are you going to mention the real hero from yesterday? Yeah, we'll do that here at the bottom of the hour. But the collision yesterday, and look, we've been talking about this for a while. We feel like Yordan Alvarez is too good of a hitter than to run the risk of injury by playing him in left field. And we understand that Yordan has talked about how he likes to do it. We understand that Yordan says that it feels like it helps him get it going offensively, although his DH numbers are just fine as well. Look, I'm not even saying that Yordan Alvarez is David Ortiz, because look, he is a decent left fielder. He is an average left fielder if you look at like the metrics. He is a way better athlete than David Ortiz. Like, you look at his sprint speed. His sprint speed's pretty fast. Like, he's not David Ortiz, so we're not calling him David Ortiz. But what he means to this offense, the fact that he's having one of the best offensive seasons in Houston Astro history, whether it's the home runs, whether it's the OPS, whether it's the RBIs, you pick the number, Yordan's in the conversation for one of the best all-time in organization history. Because of that, you can't afford to run the risk of getting him hurt in left field, and I'm hoping that everything's okay yesterday, but I hope that it's also a sign and a warning to Dusty Baker to prevent playing him in left field as much as he possibly can.
And I, you know what? And I get it. The first line of defense from Dusty and everybody else is going to be, well, if Brantley isn't hurt, then we're not doing that. That's not true, because you have been sprinkling him in from time to time and trying to get him more experience in left field. That's something you can do in the offseason if you really are hell-bent on trying to find a true position for him, because you and I have talked about the fact that at some point, ideally, he should be a first baseman, because now he doesn't have to worry about, you know, the spraining an ankle or, you know, doing something in the outfield.
I think it's much safer.
Yeah, and all he's really got to do is scoop, and it's not easy, and Yuli will tell you that, but scooping balls and, you know, and foot positioning on at first base, but that's a hell of a lot better for the team overall than putting his health and safety at risk by putting him in the outfield, because he's just not fleet of foot, and he's not an experienced outfielder, and you've seen it. He's missed. A lot of times they've been able to cover up for the fact that he misses a cutoff, he throws to the wrong base. He's still doing some kind of things that you would say are minor league mistakes in the outfield.
Yeah.
But you're never going to call him on it because of how good he is at the plate. So you're right, he should not be out there.
And I don't think he's necessarily a bad outfielder either.
No.
Like, he's got, to me, underrated speed. Like, he can get to a fly ball, and he can sprint. Like, he's a very good athlete. We see him rounding third, heading to the plate, and how fast he gets going. He has a very good arm. You remember we're throwing the dude out at the plate a couple of weeks ago, and it was clocked at, like, 94 miles per hour. So, like, he is an athlete. I understand that. But he is such a good hitter, you cannot afford to have him playing left field. The one exception you alluded to, like, if you tell me that he absolutely needs to play defense, and it's either because it's the team's interest or Yordan Alvarez is saying, look, I signed $115 million deal, 6 years. Part of that was an understanding that I was going to play on the defensive side as well because I want to do that. Then it needs to be what you just said. It needs to be converting him to a first baseman in the offseason where it's a little bit safer. It's easier on the knees. You're not looking at colliding more times than not with your shortstop going out on little Texas leaguers and little bloopers. So if he's absolutely clamoring to play defense and you're telling me it's a must-have thing, then first base is the answer for him long-term.
No question. Absolutely no doubt about it. And I think that obviously with a lot coming up with Brantley after this year, his contract expiring, trying to figure out what they're going to do next. I think that's when you truly start trying to figure out what you're going to do with Yordan, because I don't know why they're so hell-bent on having other options at designated hitter when your designated hitter happens to be the best hitter in the American League. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a surplus of talent at one position that no one else in this league has. And obviously, Aaron Judge statistically will be a guy that, from an offensive perspective, competes. But Aaron Judge is a polished outfielder. I think that you can be okay with it's not, I guess you think you're giving guys half a day off.
Yeah, I like that logic, just not when you have Yordan.
No, right, right. I mean, if it was somebody else that we were dealing with and you wanted to do a platoon system at DH or do some other things, that's fine. When you're talking about a guy that's as potent as he is offensively, how much he means and the impact he has on this team from a night-by-night basis, I don't want to screw with that. I understand he can play the outfield. I'd just rather he doesn't. Because he's so vital. Think about it. What we were thinking when that collision happened. And of course, we care about Pena too. But we've seen them get by with other shortstops.
Yeah.
But you don't want to go a long period of time without Yordan Alvarez. He just means too much to this team.
Yeah. I mean, you can't afford like a torn ACL because he's playing left field. Like, you just can't. He's too good of a bat. He means too much to this team. And the question that I wanted to ask, like, how important is it that Yordan Alvarez stop playing defense? Like, where does it rank amongst your long-term Astro thoughts? And we've talked about these quite a bit. We talk about the August 2nd trade deadline, adding a bat, adding an arm. The batting order is always a point of contention with Dusty Baker. I would put stop playing Yordan Alvarez on defense ahead of all of them. Stop playing Yordan Alvarez on defense is more important to me than upgrading at first base. It's more important to me than adding a left-handed hammer. It's more important to me than the suboptimal batting Yordan Alvarez third and not in the cleanup spot. That is the most pressing thing. You like Yordan Alvarez, if you lose him, your season is done. You're losing one of the best hitters in baseball. So it's far more significant than the batting order. It's far more significant than clamoring about the trade deadline. It's far more significant than Lance McCullers coming back. So Yordan Alvarez needs to stop playing left field, period, end of story.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, look, that I think we both are on the same page. We summed it up the best that we can, but I get it. He could play in the outfield.
Capable.
But don't. Just don't.
I mean, capable, but worth it, right?
Like, you know, if this was a team, and I'm trying to use the best example, but he's so impactful that, like, you could have teams that had 2 and 3 all-star caliber, big, load-carrying guys that could do a lot of damage, where you could say, well, you know, you could lose, you could front him for a couple of weeks if he got hurt. This is not that team. This is a different team. We know that this isn't the power-hitting team of Astros past. We know that Bregman's numbers are down. We know that without Correa in the lineup, we didn't know what we were going to get at shortstop. We know Altuve's numbers are coming up. He's probably going to hit 30 home runs. But Brantley's another guy that will give you occasional pop. Now it's all doubles and alleys, and so is Yuli. So you don't have the kind of one-and-done chances of turning around a scoreboard with a long ball like you used to, and the guy that does it for you does it on a really consistent basis. So that's why it's vitally important. He goes nowhere and doesn't get hurt.
And he might do it on a basis that's better than anybody else in club history. He's chasing Bagwell's 47. 713-780-ESPN. How pressing is it for you that Yordan Alvarez does not play defense because his bat is so good? Is it more important than the trade deadline? Is it more important than Lance McCullers? Is it more important than the batting order? 713-780-3776. Also, people are saying we got to talk about yesterday's hero. Well, who was the hero? We'll discuss next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5.
Razor sharp commentaries delivered with a purpose. You found the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Castro drives one to right field. Well hit. That ball's gone. Jason Castro's first home run of the year. His biggest swing of 2022. And the Astros lead 2-0.
Todd Callis calling the Jason Castro dong, the two-run homer in the top of the ninth. There it is, the dong for Jason Castro. Justin Verlander, the happiest man in the ballpark. He was thrilled. He was jumping for joy in the dugout. This is, of course, his song, The Ace of Spades, as he was the first pitcher to 10 wins in all of Major League Baseball. Who had that on their baseball bingo card? That Justin Verlander, at the age of 39, coming off Tommy John, had pitched in one game in the last 2 years, would be the first pitcher in Major League Baseball to double-digit wins.
It's crazy. Johnny Davis, by the way, just ran to Taco Bell again.
Okay.
I am surprised only because of the fact that what And we know that Justin Verlander, I don't want to say he's not human. He's just not like all these other pitchers.
Might not be.
Like, it's his arm isn't, right? I mean, it's crazy because even after he comes back from major surgery where everybody says, you know, when you come back from Tommy John surgery, sometimes it takes about a year to really be yourself again. So you weren't, you had low expectations because you just, you knew that at his age too, that it might, he not be, might not be himself for a while. Instead, right from the word jump, I mean, he's just mowing people down. He looks like his old self. The velocity keeps going up as he gets later in games. He's going deeper and deeper into games. He's demanding to pitch on 5 days rest instead of six. He's doing all these things that is completely fighting Father Time. But the last thing you think of, he's the best pitcher in the American League. But guess what, folks? He's the best pitcher in the American League.
Yeah, it looks like he has a really good chance of starting the All-Star game for the National League. Dusty Baker is going to be managing it,
and
too, by the way.
And his teammate should be right next to him.
Fromber?
Yep.
Yeah, Fromber should be there. Anyways, Verlander, 8 shutout innings, gave up just the 2 hits. He was fantastic. 101 pitches, too. He was kind of economical, which isn't always something you say about Verlander because he's a high strikeout guy, although this year he's getting it done more with actually less strikeouts, which is great to see. For a 39-year-old. But people were saying that the hero is Jason Castro because he hit that two-run homer. No, I mean, heard the dong for Castro.
It was a combo platter. But as much as, you know, he saved himself from being DFA'd for another day, for at least one more game, you saw the Castro of the Astro of the past, right? The guy that at least late innings in games when they needed something in the last year or so, he was able to step up. Uh-huh. That was a massive hit because, you know, the minute it happened, we went to break. And I said to you, looks like they got slim chances to win this game now because two of their better hitters are out of the lineup. Verlander's done. You just didn't expect anything much. And yet Castro, who has looked completely clueless at the plate lately, goes and does you the solid of the two-run bomb that becomes the difference in the game. And you're like, hey, I mean, that makes nothing makes you happier.
I think that Castro cemented his spot on this roster for the rest of the season yesterday in that game. And it's not even what he did in the box.
Why?
It's not even what he did whenever he hit that two-run homer in the ninth inning. The reason that Castro has cemented himself as the backup catcher for the Houston Astros for the remainder of the season, like he's starting to get an uptick in his bat, so we want to do give him credit there, tip our cap to Jason Castro for that. But McTaggart tweeted this yesterday before the game. Mm-hmm. Baker said Castro catching Verlander so much lately is a coincidence, usually a day game after a night, but it's looking more and more like Jason Castro is the personal catcher for Justin Verlander. McTaggart went on to say, this will be Verlander's 7th start in a day game this year, blah, 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 blah. This will also be the 7th time Castro has caught him. He has a 1.16 ERA with Castro and a 3.02 ERA with Maldonado. So still both very good, but obviously much better again with Castro. I think Jason Castro, for the remainder of the season, is the personal valet. He's the personal catcher for Justin Verlander. And because we know Justin Verlander makes a lot of the decisions for this team, the rotation, when he's going to pitch, what innings he's going to pitch, how deep he's going to go in games, I think Justin Verlander also is going to have say on who the backup catcher is on this team.
And I put it on the rundown today. I mean, as much as, you know, we kind of made fun of and questioned, like, how much power should Justin Verlander have, especially when half the law firm went out to talk to him late in a game a few starts ago, and he basically told them to turn around and get the bleep back to the dugout. And then proceeded to give up a bomb that made the whole thing look like maybe Justin shouldn't have that much power. But then he pitches the two gems he did on this road trip, and you go, you know what? Justin pretty much can do whatever the hell he wants as long as he keeps pitching like this.
See, I'm actually like hypocritical when it comes to this. I'll talk out of both sides of my mouth whenever it comes to this as well. Like, Justin Verlander has earned the right to be making decisions, right? Like, he should have a say on when, you know, how deep he's going into games. He should have a say on which day he's pitching. Every fifth day, we know that's what he wants. Maybe even he should have some say on who his personal catcher is. Like, I get all of that. So I agree that Verlander has built enough respect and has the resume where you have to give him the benefit of the doubt of that. You have to let him go with that. My fear with that, though, because both things can be true, my fear with that is that Justin Verlander, again, 39 years old, just a year removed from Tommy John, coming off the Tommy John surgery, is that I want him to be as fresh as he can possibly be in October when the playoffs are rolling around. Because, look, Justin Verlander yesterday was great. He was outstanding, 8 shutout innings, the 10 wins. We mentioned very good chance that he's going to start the All-Star game for the American League. That's all great, but it's June. You know what I mean? I want all of that in October, and I want to have October in mind. The Astros have the luxury because of where they are in the standings and because of which division they're in. Let's face it, the division is soft outside of the Houston Astros, but because you have that luxury, you can start looking at the forest and not the tree. Like, I get that Verlander wants to win tons of games. I get that he wants to win 300 in his career. I get that he wants to win 4,000, and he also has the pride that he wants to be a gamer and go out there every fifth day. I agree. Like, I understand that. I get that. And Verlander has built the respect for that. My concern with that is that Justin Verlander is going to, you know, he's going to empty the tank a little bit before you get to the postseason.
Yeah, look, and you know what? If it was anybody else, and we start talking about the fact that at a certain point, and I've always gone back to this, the way that the Yankees handled Jabba Chamberlain or the Nats handled Strasburg, it's just not conducive to getting the most out of a pitcher. Because you know what? Genetically and physically, pitchers can break down at any moment, yep. No matter how much you baby them. So you got to let a Luis Garcia be a Luis Garcia until he can't anymore, instead of trying to, you know, soft serve him to when he pitches because you're worried about how many innings he's pitched. You just, at a certain point, got to let it go. And I think with Verlander, it's even more of a special case in the fact that we've just got done highlighting. He's not like so many other guys. However, just like we said about Yordan and what he means to this offensive lineup, this team is in, I don't want to say shambles, but this team is in a lot of hurt if they don't have their ace at the top of the rotation. So at a certain point, whether he likes it or not, and I've talked about this in the past, someone who has and maybe it's Jim Crane, someone who has his ear and his respect has to sit him down at a certain point and go, as much as we love what you're doing, mm-hmm. and we know what you really want to do with this year and the rest of your career, we got to be a little bit smarter in terms of what we do with you from here to the end of the regular season.
And to your point, it is random, right? Like, you don't know what is good, what is bad. To me, it's more, you have more chance of getting hurt the more you pitch, right? And if you know you're going to be a playoff team, do you want Justin Verlander pitching 180 innings chasing the Cy Young? Or do you let a little bit off the pedal, right? And he goes 150, 160 innings. Maybe he doesn't get 20 wins, but he gets 15, 16. And maybe he doesn't get the Cy Young, but he finishes fourth in Cy Young. But because of that, it puts you in a better position and less likelihood that the wear and tear on the arm is there for the postseason. So it's a very difficult thing because Verlander has earned the trust, he's earned the respect, and he has the resume to demand that stuff. But on the other hand, the Astros have team goals that they want to accomplish that if Verlander, you know, he runs out of gas at the end of October, all of a sudden it's like, man, wish we would have not thrown him as much in June or July. 713-780-3776.
Before we get off that, too, the one thing that I would say is you wouldn't do that to Lance McCullers. You no. just wouldn't.
You wouldn't do that with anybody else.
Right. It's one of those rare instances where, just like we say, his velocity goes up the more pitches he throws deeper into a game, which is completely unheard of and crazy.
He's an alien.
Yeah, he does so many things. At 39, to come back from Tommy John and be the best pitcher in the American League, you have to give him a little extra rope. You have to give him a little extra leeway you probably wouldn't give to just about anybody else.
3227 saying that Yordan, which switching the conversations, mm-hmm. Yordan is young, though. Why do we treat him like he's made of glass? We need Altuve as well. Do we DH him to save him? Why just Yordan? Yeah, Yordan is made of glass. Look at the amount of games that he's
missed.
Look
at his legs. Yeah, look at the issues he's had in the past medically. It's just being smart, right? It's not like you don't trust him or it's a slap in the face to him. It's just there are certain guys, the way that they're genetically put together and the things that they've gone through, that you want to, if you're going to border one way or the other, border on the side of caution.
I would say, too, that left field is more dangerous than second base because there's obstacles there. You can run into a shortstop. You can run into a wall. You run into the warning track. You move a little bit funny. And I understand you can do all those things at second base as well, but I think left field's a little more dangerous. And then I would say first base, probably the least dangerous of any of the spots on the field. Looking long-term there, they're not going to make that move right now. But then also to, like, have a very real conversation for just a second. Which of the two could you, like, I hate even bringing this up because people, why are you bringing up this, Branham? Come on, the Astros are doing great. We don't need to talk about this. If you lost one the rest of the year, which of the two would you rather it be?
Oh, God.
Can't be Yordan. Yordan's one of the best hitters in all of baseball. It cannot be Yordan. I'm not sure you can survive either one, but you have a better chance to survive an Altuve injury, like a season-ending injury, than a Yordan season-ending injury.
I think the main reason why I would tell you you're right is the fact that, like I said, the offense relies on him so much for so many things. without Verlander, you still have a fighting chance because you got seven starters. Uh-huh. And so you've got other starters. They're not Justin Verlander, but they're capable of doing enough to keep you in games as long as you have Jordan in an offense that can score some runs for you. So I think that because if you had to choose between one or the other, you have a backup plan with Verlander that you really don't have for Jordan.
And it's also, too, like, which of the ones are you protecting? Because Jordan, like, he has very bad knees. He is, like, a big athlete. Whereas Altuve, he's had, like, the hamstring pulls and things like that. But he's also been, you know, pretty healthy over the course of his career in terms of, like, serious injuries. He's had some, you know, hamstring strains and things like that. Whereas Jordan's missed some seasons. Altuve's never done that. So you have to throw that into the equation as well. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. So we've had a lot of recent debate about what Davis Mills needs to be. But what about one prevalent narrative surrounding him last year? It's Skiller Beast on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
I did a bit of a Branham deep dive. One of the things we talk about with Davis Mills, like a lot of people say that Davis Mills, over his last five games, he was a different quarterback, which it's fair. Like I'm not going to argue that point. I think he was a different quarterback. Over his final five games, his second stint as QB versus his first stint at QB. But I think at times people can overrate those five games. Like, oh, Seattle, he played really well. He threw for over 300 yards. In a game they lost by 20. You know what I mean? Like, was how great of a game really was that for a quarterback?
Right.
They beat Jacksonville, so he wasn't asked to do a whole lot. 209 yards, two touchdowns and a pick. Not bad. Good. His best game was against the Chargers, in my opinion, when he threw 250, had two touchdowns, no picks, was efficient. Completed 78% of his passes. That was a really good game. That's the game I look at for Davis Mills last year. I'm like, okay, if Davis Mills can play at that level consistently for 17 games over an NFL season, Texans can be on to something. The game they lost against San Francisco, though, a week later was the exact opposite. He was terrible. A game that the offense could not score, 163 yards, touchdown, and a pick. It wasn't good. And then the final game against Tennessee, that's the one where the Titans jumped out 21-0. It seemed like they had the game at hand at halftime, and the Texans, they found something at the locker room, and they made some adjustments. They came out and had a very strong second half. Davis Mills threw for 300 yards, three touchdowns, no interceptions. It looked very good, but it also looked like the Titans were in a prevent defense that allowed for a lot of the underneath stuff. But still, you know, it was still significant football. So I went and did a deep dive to figure out how much of what Davis Mills did in that second stint as quarterback, those last five games, his last five starts of the season, how much of those came in garbage time? Like, how much was he just racking stats, racking volume, when, quite frankly, it didn't matter?
Can I ask on that real quick?
Sure.
The garbage time definition would be at any time in the game when you're down by a significant amount?
So I actually asked Brendan to define it for me.
Okay.
Because I didn't want there to be any bias into my study.
Yep.
So I asked Brendan, what is garbage time in your opinion? And he said that anything within 21 points, which, I mean, I think is a pretty high range,
it is,
right?
A little higher than
so
I thought.
So anything within 21 points through the first three quarters is still not garbage time. It had to be more than 21 through the first three quarters, which, quite frankly, Davis Mills was never in that situation. So you can just throw out that parameter right now because Davis Mills was never down by more than 21 points within the first three quarters. Closest was the Tennessee Titan game where they were down 21-0, but not over those 21 points. The second part was, I believe it was two possessions with about 3 to 5 minutes left in the game. Like, if you're down by 14, 3 to 5 minutes left in the game, that now is garbage time. Davis Mills was only in garbage time twice. He was in garbage time in the Seattle game, which they lost by 20 points. And in garbage time, Davis Mills was 9 of 12 for 85 yards. So that's substantial, right? Now you're looking at 75% passer. You're looking at almost 100 yards in garbage time in a game where he threw for 331. So almost 100 of his yards in a game where he threw for 331 were when the game was already decided in garbage time. The only other game that was in garbage time by Brendan standards was the San Francisco game, in which they lost on the road by 16 to Trey Lance, by the way. He only one possession in garbage time, though, because San Francisco only had more than a 14-point lead within the minute parameter that we illustrated, and that was late in the game, and Mills late in the game went 6 for 6 for 57 yards, which pretty significant. In a game where he threw for 163 yards, 57 of those came late in the fourth quarter when the game was already over. So really, in the actual part where the game was competitive, he threw for 110 yards. So, like, he wasn't in garbage time a ton, But the times that he was, twice, just twice, they certainly influenced the numbers. And when we look back at that five-game span, there is nobody that is taking that into consideration.
Okay, and that's fair, and that's great. I just think that, and I appreciate your deep dive
on
it. Because the thing that always concerns me is, and again, I'm not trying to compare Davis Mills to, you name it, Dak Prescott or Deshaun Watson or other guys. But I think that a lot of times that definition, that's why I asked, is so vitally important to the discussion because of the fact that Dak Prescott got paid a whole hell of a lot of money coming off of a year where his stats were through the roof, but it was because they were playing from behind in almost every game and he was slinging it around the yard. Deshaun Watson, in a four-win season, was playing from behind a majority of the year and got a ton of fluffy yards and a ton of fluffy stats. Now, that's not to say that either one of those guys aren't good quarterbacks. That's just to say sometimes you have to factor in all the different elements that go into when a guy is able to get the numbers that he's getting. I think that the easiest way I always look at Davis Mills is it's two chapters in his book. The first chapter was not pretty. And,
right.
and there was a lot of turmoil and there was a lot of things that made you kind of cringe and go, I don't know, you know, you in the discussion you and I had early before this even got to the point where he was playing consistently was maybe you were right. Maybe this guy doesn't even belong in the league. And then when he came back for the second stint, at least, regardless of what the stats were, at least he looked like it wasn't too big for him. At least it looked like...
See, that's not completely true. Because in the San Francisco game, it was. Like, he was awful.
But let me clarify, okay? It didn't mean that he wasn't still going to make mistakes. Because, you know, I was harping on the fact he was still staring down receivers.
Yep.
He was still doing things that I knew that he needed to work on. But in terms of having control of the huddle, in terms of being poised when you got your bell rung and your cage rattled or things didn't go your way, he at least stuck his nose back in there and kept going and looked like he could move the team and have some drives where they could get some points. So he wasn't perfect by any stretch. And he was going to have to improve, but at least he looked more like he belonged than someone that should be looking for a job in one of those leagues that are playing football right now.
Which one, XFL or USFL?
You pick it. I don't care.
Canadian Football League, I think he'd be very good there. See, somebody texted in, 713-780-ESPN.
He's a Rough Rider from Ottawa. Are they still allowed to call him that?
No idea.
Okay.
8788 says garbage time the whole Buffalo game. That's true, but that was his first stint as the starter. We're looking primarily at the second stint of when Davis Mills was starting. Because the first stint, to me, I crumple that up and throw it away because that was atrocious. Like, that was not an NFL-level quarterback, whether it's first team, whether it's second team. Like, that level of play is not sustainable for a quarterback that can be employed in the National Football League. Now, his second start, he looks like he is a borderline starting quarterback in the NFL. He, like you said, he showed some flashes where it's like, okay, this guy belongs. But then he also showed some flashes like against San Francisco where it's like, you can't win with this type of play. And no one's really expecting a rookie to win, especially with where the Texans were at last year. And that's why he should get a chance in 2022. Nobody's advocating that Davis Mills should not get a chance to be the starting quarterback in 2022. This is more projecting what you think he is going to be. And a lot of people look at those last five games, and I think the way that you look at it is the best way to look at it, where it's more eye test. Okay, he looks like he's capable of leading an offensive drive and getting points from this offensive drive versus the way some other people look at it. Because you hear people all the time, well, he threw for 331 yards against the Seattle Seahawks, so how can you tell me he's not very good? Well, 85 of those 331 came when the game was by far yep. decided and in garbage time late in the game that they lost by 20 points. I'm not going to give Davis Mills credit for having a good game in which they lost by 20 and a third of his offensive numbers come in garbage time. I'm not going to give him credit for that. Even the win against Jacksonville, like 209 yards, game manager, that's great. Doesn't really show you that he can put his team on his back. Charger game is the one where I look at and like, okay, that guy, if you get Davis Mills, that the way he played against the Chargers, that guy could give you something. That guy could give you a shot to win in the NFL. San Francisco? No. He was atrocious in that game. That was the worst of his last five starts that he had. In the Tennessee Titan game, that was a really good start. You know, 300 yards, three touchdowns. Most of that, though, came whenever they were behind 21-0, and he did get them back in the game. So credit to Davis Mills for that. But whenever people just look at the numbers so, like it paints the picture, right? And I think that's something that you don't do. Like, you're willing to say, okay, this guy looks like he's capable of leading an offensive drive, taking a team down the field, and scoring some points. He can be the quarterback of an efficient offense, which he wasn't in his first stint. I would say that he was in his second stint, but not to the extent that the Mills Mafia wants you to believe.
Yeah, no, look, I think that that's why, and this is such a deep dive that some, it's not even worth.
I'm saying, for this
part of the conversation, we can have it. I'm talking about the overall as it relates to all the major sports. It's that balance between analytics and the eye test. And it differs from sport to sport, but both need to be taken seriously and respected as having a factor in how you evaluate a player. Because, as we've said, the numbers can say one thing, and they can be through the roof and paint the picture that this player is either on the trajectory to become or should already be considered one of the better players in the sport. But then when you look at things like the intangibles, the chemistry with different players, the mental aspect of understanding defenses and the plays called and the route trees and your progressions and things like that, that's why it's always a balance. It differs from sport to sport, but neither one of them should be discounted or be looked at like they're not a factor. That's why there's so much more to still evaluate with Davis Mills. As much as we know and we've seen, there's so much more we have to see, and we have to see it throughout the 17 games this season so that we can make a fair analysis using both. I think he has the ability to take a team, and like I said, you know me, I look for not wins and losses, but can you move a team down the field consistently to score points? Are you a reason that they're in the game, or are you a reason why they're not?
Yeah. To me, you can be on both ends of the spectrum and still believe that Davis Mills should be the starter in 2022. To me, this is, at least from like my point of view and the point that I was trying to get across, is that like the numbers and the way the Mills Mafia say, well, his numbers in the last five games better than every rookie quarterback in 2021, you're not really being honest with yourself. Like, okay, if you just stack up the yards thrown in his last five games and compare it to Mac Jones, and you compare it to Trevor Lawrence, you're really being a box score analyst there. Like, you're not really reading between the lines. You're not really looking at those games. Like, if you want to sell to me that Davis Mills could be good, don't tell me his numbers in his final five games, whenever he was racking up garbage stats in two of the five games. Tell me he's going to be what he's going to be whenever he played the Chargers last year. Because I'll look at that Davis Mills and say, okay, that guy's got a shot. But if you're rattling off the Seattle numbers when they lost by 20 and a majority of those numbers came in garbage time, I'm not going to buy that. You're not going to sell me on that.
That's fair. That's absolutely fair. Look, I think that everybody has their own like hot buttons, right, of what works for them and what they think. The most important thing is what Nick Caserio thinks and what the rest of this team thinks. And I think that this year, I think that you've got the right mix. You got a guy that's more analytically driven in a guy like Caserio, right? But also understands the intangible.
Mm-hmm.
You got a guy at head coach who's a little bit more old school that is going to go with the eye test. And he's going to see him every day. He's going to see him at practice. He's going to see him in games. And I think practice has become so much more vital this season because now we're not worried about where we are in a game and what's the situation with an opponent and how that factors in. Now we're worried about with the ones on offense versus the ones on defense. Is he capable of doing the things that an NFL quarterback needs to do?
Look, it's only year two, but it's probably make or break for Davis Mills. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Coming up next, there's some that think the Texans have the worst roster in the NFL. Do they? It's Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.